Okay, guys, welcome to the show. This is Deborah Gets Red Pilled, episode 204. It is Thursday, December 7th, pretty close to 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Things going well up here in the Pacific Northwest. It's been storming like nobody's business. We're under flood warning. Rain stopped a little bit today. Sun came out for a little bit, but I think it's going to pick up again tonight. So, trying to stay dry, trying to stay out of the mud as much as possible, but it's pretty tough to do this time of year. But guys, we are a value for value production. So we run the show on all my money and generous donations from our listeners, which have been pretty hit and miss lately. So if you guys are getting any value out of the show, maybe reciprocate and help us out. I think, we've got some bills coming up, our yearly bills coming up soon. So if you guys want to help out with that, just let us know all the ways to, help us monetarily are in the show notes. You can do Venmo or PayPal or Cash App. That's that kind of stuff. Otherwise just, leave us 5-star reviews, leave us fun reviews. We'll read them if they're worthy of being read on air. And I just want to say thanks to everybody for who's still sticking around. You know, our numbers aren't the best, but I think we're putting out some good shows, good fun shows, some topics that are pretty tough. And I was surprised with how much Deborah came prepared on the last episode. It kind of took the fun out of it, but it was pretty impressive too. So it was neat to hear her. I think she knew more about some of the in the weeds stuff than I did. But she is not here right now. She's supposed to be. I don't know where she is. I sent her a couple texts and I definitely reminded her yesterday. A little upsetting, but our guest is here and it is just about time to let him in. So we'll pause. We'll be right back. Okay. Thanks, guys. All right, guys, welcome back. So today's guest is a writer and fantastic researcher. And if you come from any of the circles that I'm from, you've definitely heard him. Richard Booth is the authority, one of the few that I trust on this topic. And we finally got him here. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for your kind words. This is definitely a subject that I'm very interested in, to say the least.
Yeah, and you are actually from Oklahoma, correct?
That's right, yeah. I was born and raised in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I was in Tulsa when the Oklahoma City bombing happened.
How far away is Tulsa from Oklahoma City?
Tulsa is like northeast, and I don't offhand, I don't know how many miles it is, but it's like, if I were to say, maybe an hour or something like that. Got not it. Very far. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. How old were you in 1995 when the bombing occurred?
95, let's see, I would have been 18 years old, 17 or 8, no, 17 at that time. Yeah.
Got it. Yeah, so you're, I think, two years older than me. I was 15. Okay. But I remember it happening, and I was telling Deborah on our last show that for me, it's kind of, I never went like real deep into JFK or anything like that. But to me, maybe it's kind of my JFK because it's sort of similar in that it's so convoluted. There's multiple people running around saying they're the same guy and all sorts of crazy stuff like that. It's hard to keep track of everything. And it's really captured my attention, and I love hearing about it. I told you I'm 400 pages through Aberration in the Heartland of the Real by Dr. Wendy Painting. And I loved listening to her talk with Jimmy Fallon Gong on Program to Chill for their 11 parts series. And then I've also listened to the, I think, 8 or 9 part thing you did with Jose from No Way Jose. Mm-hmm. And that's great too. But so what was going on in let's go back to the beginning. What was it like growing up in Oklahoma? Were you always kind of a curious kid who looked at things through a different lens, or did that all come later?
Yeah, I was always, I'd say, curious about different things, and I just really like learning about like historical events. And it's interesting you mentioned like, it being like the JFK assassination 4 years. That's actually exactly the way that I view it. It's like this was my Kennedy assassination because after I did follow it when it happened in very short order. It very much had the same impact on me that it might have on, say, like if my dad saw Jack Ruby kill Lee Harvey Oswald. If he wasn't interested in what happened at that moment, he sure was. Well, with Oklahoma City, it was not long before I was like, whoa, what's going on here? I need to find out more. And so, like you ask about, like, was I curious about things? Or I still remember like asking my grandmother when I was like 9 or 10 about like who is Jack Ruby? What happened with that? And so I was definitely always interested in different historical events.
What was the climate like in, oh, because you're 17 or 18, that's an age where you can remember things pretty well. What was the climate like in Oklahoma, like leading up to it, and during, after the bombing? Was it sort of a 9/11 type situation where everybody came together and trusted
Yeah.
the mainstream, or what was going on?
So yeah, this was a time when, like, right when it happened, immediately most people kind of assumed that it was Arab terrorists. And that didn't last very long, of course, because when the official story came out, that adjusted people's opinions and they aligned pretty much. They would align with whatever the authorities were saying. And what you found was people did sort of come together in one way. Like, what you found is that people who wanted to get to the bottom of this and were not even saying things like, oh, McVeigh didn't do it. Nobody, no one was saying that. But there were some of us at the time who were saying, well, what about John Doe number two? Who are these other people? I want them to go to jail too. Well, if you did that, you were almost cast as like people viewed you as somehow being a supporter of McVeigh. Or, and Wendy does a great example in her book of illustrating this. She talks about how the dissidents, which would be like journalists or even victims who were impacted by the bombing, who wanted to get to the bottom of this, they were classed as almost like a thought offender, and you are now somehow just like the terrorist. And that really is how it was viewed. Like if I were to talk about this back then, it immediately would make people angry, just because I'm asking about this or that, they'd get so mad, an emotional response.
Yeah, so similar to post 9/11, where
Absolutely.
you're either with us or you're with the terrorists.
That's right. Yeah.
Terrorists. That's interesting. Do you recall, 'cause in the fog of war right afterwards, we saw it with, the BBC reporting that Tower 7 had collapsed before it had gone down. Did you stuff like that? Do you remember anything from local newspapers or news reports that was, that didn't stick with the official narrative in the
Yeah.
aftermath?
On the first day, there was a report out of Oklahoma City that was also broadcast in Tulsa. And the reason I know about this is that my high school at the time, they had a grant from the local cable company, which was at that time called TCI Cablevision. And they provided a grant to, I don't know if it was just our school or other schools, but as a result of that grant, we had like cable televisions and VCRs in all of our classrooms. And so we would turn on, and a lot of teachers, depending on the class, were letting us watch news coverage of it. So I saw that while I was there at school that day. And then after the bombing, I was watching coverage at home. And at one point, there was a report that was talking about a brown pickup truck that was seen in the vicinity of the blast. And the report further went on to say, like, that there were Middle Eastern people associated with this truck. And that was really curious, as this report kind of happened almost at the same time or the day before the sketches came out, which showed that it was two white males. And I remembered immediately, I'm like, boy, that's weird. What's that about?
Yeah, so the John Doe number two thing, when Timothy McVeigh is seen exiting the Ryder truck before the bombing, another man is also reported by some eyewitnesses, and there was a very like was it the largest FBI manhunt up to date at that time to go look for John Doe number two?
That's right. It was the largest manhunt in history for sure. And that really is what grabbed my attention on this case, because the day after the bombing, pretty much it was the 20th, I think, that sketches were produced of John Doe 1 and John Doe 2. And these two sketches were considered the primary suspects. And so as soon as I saw that, my initial thought was, who are these people? I want to know. Well, what their motivation was, why they did this, and who they are. I want to know the true story. And so when within a day or so Tim McVeigh is captured, that answers, part of the question as to who these people are, but the other guy is still outstanding. And so I continued watching the news and reading the paper because I want to know who's this other guy. And ultimately, it was like 2 months later that the FBI comes out and says, oh, he doesn't even exist. That was in June of 95. And when I heard that, that's kind of when I was like, oh my God, that this is like, I'm watching a conspiracy unfold. This is absolutely a criminal conspiracy, and also the type of conspiracy you might read about in history books where someone's questioning the event. I knew then this is one of those things, and I need to read everything I can about it, pay close attention, and see what's happening here, because we're not going to get the full story if this is what they're telling us.
Yeah, and the composite drawing of McVeigh was pretty convincing and pretty accurate, correct?
It was, yeah, it looked a lot like him.
Yeah, and then so it seems strange that there would have been one of the John Doe two from probably the same people that described McVeigh that he just doesn't exist.
Right, it is indeed the very same people, and that's a point that I often make when someone talks about, oh, well, these witnesses, they were just confused. And I say, well, I can understand people being confused, that sort of thing. However, if their recollection was so accurate to produce this John Doe 1 sketch that resembles McVeigh, how do you explain them somehow just fabricating or imagining this second guy? I tend to think if they were so accurate about this first guy, then they probably were also accurate about John Doe too.
Yeah, exactly. And so when McVeigh was captured, he was traveling north of Oklahoma City by a couple hours and was caught by what highway, like state troopers or.
Yeah, he was driving north, and he was basically pulled over by a guy named Charlie Hanger, who was, I want to say he was Highway Patrol. And he was basically pulled over because he had no license plate on his vehicle. And at that time, Hanger noticed that McVeigh had a concealed firearm. And one thing that's interesting that you look at this, if McVeigh was, such this criminal mastermind, he certainly didn't act like it not long after the bombing. He's basically driving, he's got a 45 on a shoulder holster, so he's got this gun strapped to him, and he has like a 6-inch knife mounted on his belt. Like he was strapped up like he was ready. And if you're a criminal of any sort of intelligence, if you've done something like this, it's time to maybe put the 45 in the trunk of the car
Yeah.
and lay low. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And how soon after the bombing was he captured?
I want to say it was maybe about an hour he was taken into custody, maybe a little over an hour. He's taken it maybe, oh, could have been about an hour and a half, but definitely less than 2 hours. So it was very, very soon after. And what's important to note is at the time this happened, they didn't think that this guy had anything to do with the bombing. It was simply, oh, you're carrying a concealed weapon, take you into custody for that. And so that's what happened. He was taken into and put in the jail, and in Perry, Oklahoma, where he remained for several days. It was several days later that the FBI showed up at a Noble County courthouse to take him into custody. And that is where we get this now classic like video and photos of him being perp walked right out of the courthouse wearing the prison jumpsuit.
And
And
the best, right?
yeah, well, he actually, now that I mention it, I don't think he had a vest on that time. I
Okay.
think what you're thinking of is Terry Nichols had he they had him in a vest in his orange jumpsuit in one of these classic photos. But one thing that McVeigh talked about is that he was afraid when they were taking him out of that courthouse that someone was going to pull a quote Jack Ruby on him.
Yeah.
He was very scared of that at the time. And that's I think probably a reasonable concern, especially if you know that you're involved in this plot with three or four other people, and now you're getting caught. These kind of guys that he was working with were not going to just let him, run his mouth or possibly implicate them. So there was probably danger, not from grieving victims, but perhaps from co-conspirators. And at the time, Danny Coulson, this FBI agent who was involved in picking up McVeigh, he had that same thought on his mind, was that there might be other conspirators out here. And he actually expressed that to the judge. Well, he goes to the judge who McVeigh was going to be put before that day for the firearms deal. And this judge has to relinquish custody to the FBI. And this agent, Danny Coulson, tells him, look, there are other guys out there now who are at large, and they might put a law rocket through your courthouse or a stinger into your courthouse. And I thought it very interesting that Danny Coulson actually used that as his excuse, telling us that he had to have some sort of reasonable information, some sort of information that would have made him prompted him to say that. And as it turns out, there were agents with or people within this Patriot community who had Stinger missiles, as Wendy Painting is researching that now, and it's part of the whole PATCON operation was tracing the proliferation of Stinger missiles through the Patriot community. So when Coulson said that, it was really interesting to me. In later years, I thought, wow, look, he knows at that point he's thinking about PATCON and he's thinking about these Stinger missiles that these groups are expected suspected of having.
Got it. So everybody that's into this research now knows that PATCON's a thing. It's my favorite. 90s stuff is 90s PATCON and black helicopter stuff is my favorite stuff to get into. And I'm well versed in Ruby Ridge and Waco. Waco really hit a nerve with me as a little kid. I was just really, really interested in it. I didn't really understand the complexity and that there was maybe a different story besides what was told on the TV, but I've always been interested in that. But PATCON, that was not revealed as a big overreaching
Even as a
agenda
program until,
until when later in the early
oh yeah, in the
2000s.
two exactly in the early 2000s. I mean, at the time we didn't know about it at all, and I you could say that I was kind of a parapolitical thinker in the late 90s, like 97, 98. I was, on mailing lists on the internet where I was on this Oklahoma City bombing mailing list called the John Doe Times, where people were circulating, in 97, 98, 99, they're circulating news clippings about the Oklahoma City bombing. So I was very plugged in at that time, and none of us knew about PATCON. And had we known about it, we probably would have made some sort of connection, or we would have seen parallel traces to McVeigh and his milieu, which I think is still a ripe area for research that we don't have the full story on yet.
Yeah, being on those mailing lists probably got you on some other lists as well.
It might have, for sure.
What can you tell us about what was going on in that political climate? And was PATCON was being run by a multi-agency FBI? Who?
It was primarily an FBI operation, PATCON being the FBI's, their nomenclature is they will take like multiple words, like in this case, Patriot conspiracy, and they kind of slam them together for the name of their program. Like the Martin Luther King investigation was called Murkin, Murkin, which was short for like Murder King, you know. So yeah, Pat Conn was primarily FBI, but most certainly in a wide-ranging large investigation like this, the FBI calls this a major case, domestic or a class one major case undercover operation. And so as a result of that, they did have to have interface with ATF, and there was actually a joint task force at that time that we believe Danny Colson was on. He was on that task force, and myself and now deceased researcher named Roger Charles, you know, rest in peace. He was kind of my mentor on on this case, and he Roger Charles and JD Cash basically both say that Danny Colson was part of this task force where they were in, he was in Oklahoma City 9 hours before the bombing, Colson was. And they believe that it relates to this task force and that they were in some way, they had surveillance on McVeigh, and they intended to basically put the cuffs on him and capture him in the act of delivering the bomb. And that things obviously went really, really wrong. And, you know, and we could maybe talk more about that evidence for that, which I think is compelling or interesting.
Yeah, I'd love to. Let me hear it.
Yeah, so
Well, first off, is Coulson still around?
he's still alive.
Does he ever talk candidly with anyone?
He's in his 80s, but he does on occasion. He actually has a history since about 2004 of speaking pretty candidly on this case. He talked to the BBC in like 2004, and he on that program talked about how there were 20 witnesses who saw McVeigh with other people on the morning of the bombing. And Colson said, you know, I could understand if it was one or two, but 20 people. 20 people say, yeah, I saw him. That's pretty powerful. And so to have someone of Danny Colson's stature come out in 2004 and say that was a big departure from what you normally see from FBI agents. And it did send kind of it had an impact. He was quoted in all the newspapers talking about it. They all quoted his comments from the show. I thought it was one of the best things about that BBC program. And then more recently, Colson was on this podcast that's run by like kind of a spook or this so-called operator. He has a podcast called The Team House. His name is Jack Murphy, and
Yeah,
he pretty
I've listened to some of those before. I've listened to him have he had on an ATF guy that like infiltrated a bunch of biker gangs. I listened to
Oh,
that
right.
one.
That's probably
Yeah.
J. Dobbins. Yeah, I'll have to look at
Not J.
that.
Dobbins, but another guy similar to him. So,
Okay. Yeah,
yeah.
very, very interesting. Yeah, he had on Colson in like, I want to say it was 2021. And when I found it, I'm like, oh, I got to see this because it seems like he just every time he opens his mouth, he lets something else slip. So he goes on that program and he was asked by Murphy about Andy Strassmeyer, the head of security at Elohim City. And can we, you know, he asked about that, and Colson gave a pretty forthcoming answer where he said, now I'm not saying that this is my theory, but it's a theory. And so it's his way of kind of disavowing. He's saying, I'm going to say something, but don't hold me to it.
I
So
can't
he said,
confirm or deny.
basically, yes. And he says, what we think is that Andy Strassmeyer might have put McVeigh up to this, or, you know, basically attributed to Strassmeyer a leadership role in the bombing plot. And then he asks the question of who is Strassmeyer working for? Because anybody who's a reasonable person who looks at Andy Strassmeyer, they can tell that he obviously is some sort of mole for an intelligence agency, right? He's supposedly living at this neo-Nazi compound, and he's this their quote unquote head of security. Yet this is a guy who speaks fluent Hebrew.
Yeah, not the kind of guy you'd expect at a Nazi place, if you know what I
That's
mean.
right. I'm certain the people at Elohim City did not know that he spoke Hebrew, and they did not know that he had been on patrol with the IDF, that he had had an Israeli girlfriend, that he had lived on a kibbutz in Israel. And so you look at that and you're like, well, obviously he's like, you know, this guy's like a federal agent or asset of some sort, you know. This is not the kind of guy who's a neo-Nazi. He's a neo-Nazi doesn't go over there and rub elbows with the IDF. That's not, you know, that's absurd.
Yeah. And hadn't his dad been some sort of Israeli politician or diplomat or something like that?
Yeah, his dad was a high level German politician.
Oh,
He
okay.
yeah, because Andy's from Germany, and so that makes it interesting too that he learned Hebrew because obviously that was a choice of his. He wanted to learn this skill, and he just like he wanted to go over there and live on a kibbutz or train with the IDF. He made these choices because and. Normally, his career path would have been, just something in within Germany. He grows up in Germany. His dad's a German politician who worked under Helmut Kohl, who was kind of a Secretary of State, the equivalent of that in Germany. And so, yeah, it's interesting. He's got family members too that are also higher in government. Like his brother is like on the city council in one of these large cities. I want to say it was Berlin. So he's kind of a black sheep, so-called fortunate son of a prominent German family. But I think that that's just his excuse when he says, "Oh, I'm a black sheep." Like no, you're like a basically like an intelligence agent who did a really, really bad job in Oklahoma. And so now he presents himself as, oh, I'm this black sheep, and oh, I'm just this folksy guy who has an interest in people living off the land in Oklahoma. And the bottom line is, no, you're not. If you find yourself in Elohim City as the head of security at right after Ruby Ridge and Waco, and you come over here literally like weeks after the failed sedition trial of 1988. The timing there is so interesting. He first came to the United States right after the federal government lost that sedition trial, and I look at it and I'm like, well, they had a plan. If we lose this sedition trial against all of these white supremacist figures, what we need to do is insert somebody into that community so that we can entrap them. And that's what it looks like happened.
Got it. Guys, Deborah is here. She
I
decided to join us finally.
sincerely apologize. I'm very embarrassed. I'm
You're fine. Last time I was scheduled to come on here, I completely spaced it. So my apologies there. And
thank goodness.
yes.
Deborah, we've been talking for about half an hour. Welcome to the show. This is Richard, and this has been a awesome conversation so far. We're talking about we're getting into Andreas Strassmeyer. Richard, can you talk about what Elohim City was? Where it was, would it be described as neo-Nazi or
Yeah,
white supremacy? Like they're actually okay.
for sure. Yeah, this was
And
like a
it's
compound that was on the border between Oklahoma and I want to say like right up there, Oklahoma
Arkansas.
and Arkansas. Yeah,
Got it. So
right
in
on the
the is
border.
that the Ozarks?
Yeah, it's very near the Ozarks, and it's basically a white separate supremacist community. They, I think, like to call themselves white separatist, but I mean, really, come on, what's the
Yeah.
difference? And all the
Right.
people that are going through there are these terrorist types, like bank robbers and murderers and people
Yeah.
dealing in explosives and guns, just
Yeah.
absolutely bad figures for sure.
Yeah, I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, so in the 80s when all this stuff this was kind of the epicenter of it. And we always knew about the Aryan Nations and things like that. I read at the suggestion of Winnie Painting, I picked up the book The Silent Brotherhood. Have you read that?
Oh, fantastic book. I've read that three or four times. I think
Yeah.
anybody who wants to learn about the Oklahoma City bombing, I actually put that book. I have a recommended reading list that I put on Substack, and I include that on there because it's just so foundational to understanding the people who are behind that.
Yeah, and it tells the story of Bob Matthews, who was he's kind of a John Bircher guy who became a Mormon. He was like a tax protester, and then just kept going a little bit further and further and further, and then eventually ended up, creating this whole bank robbing gang that was kind of working out of the Aryan Nations, but not really. And he
Yeah, they
was,
were
he was,
creating their own thing, kind of.
yeah, he was in, they were like all over the Pacific Northwest, all the way from like Montana to Oregon. And he was up in Washington, I think, is where his
And
property was.
Medellin Falls, I think it was called.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, it's kind of a, it's a good book because it's a precursor, because that was all in the early, mid to, you know, mid 80s,
That's
earlier
right.
in the mid 80s, so it would have been before PatCon. But he talks about in there, you know, being, or he doesn't talk about it, but they talk about their and it's not a conspiracy book at all, it's just a
Right,
good,
not at all.
it's from, you know, I think it was written in 1989 when they actually still did journalism. Like a mainstream guy who could still write a good journalistic book.
Great
And
journalist who wrote that book, Kevin Flynn.
yeah, it even has a on the cover of the issue that I got, it has a little blurb from Morris Dees, which I think is
Really?
funny. And
That's
he was
ironic, yeah.
Morris Dees was actually on, supposedly on their hit list.
Oh yeah, for
They
sure.
actually pulled off a hit of, I forget the guy's name, the like, he was kind of like
Alan Berg.
Alan Berg, who was like this flamboyant, outrageous Jewish shock jock from
Yes.
Denver, I think, but he was syndicated kind of semi-nationally.
If
But
you've
yeah,
ever
that's,
seen this Oliver Stone film called Talk Radio with Eric Bogosian, it's a fictional film about basically a Jewish shock jock who starts to draw the ire of white supremacist kooky listeners.
got it.
And it's all based on that.
What's it called? Shock jock?
It's called Talk Radio.
Talk radio.
Yeah, it came out around, I want to say, like 89 or 90. I recommend it. It's very good. Eric Bogosian, who stars in it, is fantastic. And it really looks more like obviously you can tell it's based on a stage play because there's a lot of dialogue in it,
Got it.
you know. Yeah.
Yeah. That'd probably
What
be
was the name? I'm sorry. What was the name of the person before the radio,
Who was
before
the
Berg?
guy who was killed?
Yeah.
Yeah, Alan Berg, Berg.
Oh, but there was one that you had mentioned before, Alan, that also.
Well, not someone who was killed, but I did mention Kevin Flynn, but I
That's it.
think, yeah,
Yeah.
he's the guy who
Okay.
wrote the book. I'm forgetting the name now. See, I'm getting old. I'm
Silent
finding
Brotherhood.
my yes, Silent Brotherhood, yes.
Yeah. But oh yeah, and there's also a it's not very good. A really loosely based on Robert Matthews' life, there's a Tom Berenger film.
Oh, that's right. Yep.
Oh, I
I know what
forget
you're
what it's
talking about. I
called.
can't remember the name of it, but
Yeah.
yeah, it was supposed to be based on Matthews and
Yeah,
Berenger.
because
Kind of his role kind of does show him as this charismatic leader, blue collar guy, who has this insidious racism going on.
yeah, so that's out there. So the thing, I can't remember where I heard the stat and what it is, but what percentage of Elohim City was either like federal agents or some sort of CI informant?
I don't know about percentages, but what I can say is they probably had at least, in terms of like law enforcement assets, there were at least a half a dozen there. Probably at some point they may have had as many as 10 to 12, but
Yeah.
that we know of, at least five or six people there were for sure informants. And you have a range, right? You've got people who are like informants and cooperating witnesses, all the way on up to like maybe people who are provocateurs, like Andy Strassmeyer. So you've got this kind of this whole range of them there. And Jesse Trinidad, an attorney who does Freedom of Information Act lawsuits basically now, he said you couldn't sit down at Elohim City, you know, with three or four people without half of them or more, you know, being informants.
He was the fellow whose brother got.
Yes, that's right. His brother was murdered in prison, and it caused him to really, when he starts investigating it, finds out that it might be due to a mistaken identity.
Yes.
Yeah. How aware were the residents at these compounds are all over. How aware were they that they were so infiltrated?
I think that they knew. And what's interesting too is that the leader, the spiritual leader of the community, Robert Millar, it came out in the newspaper that he himself was an FBI informant,
Oh,
which I,
yeah.
yeah.
Was he a Christian identity guy?
He was like a Christian identity pastor who ran the community. He was their so-called spiritual leader. What I think he was doing is I think he was trying to kind of game the FBI. Like, he thought maybe he could manipulate and disinform them, but in a relationship like that, you kind of sell your soul, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know Deborah watched A Noble Lie, which is a pretty good documentary that came
Yeah.
out in about 2010, sometime around there. What are your thoughts on, I know it's not a perfect documentary. What are your thoughts on that movie?
Yeah, so on that program, I think that the segment on Terry Yeake was really good. I think the segment, the part of it that it's about Trinidu, they mentioned that a little bit, and they have some interviews with Jesse Trinidu. That's good. There are parts of it that I don't think are very good, so it's hit or miss, but ultimately, I think a person who's interested in the subject would do well to watch it.
Yeah, I've heard you speak about it before, and I'm maybe guilty of perpetuating one main source of, maybe it's not misinformation, but one thing that you think that they got wrong in it. What do you think about the McVeigh in the tank scene? The McVeigh lookalike in the tank?
All right, the McVeigh, yeah. So you got this guy named Bill Bean, and he basically has footage of from an army base, and it was sometime like I want to say 94, 95, around that time. And in the footage, there's a guy who is parking this like Bradley. And this guy, Bill Bean, alleges that the guy who is parking the Bradley is Tim McVeigh. And the significance of that would be, well, McVeigh is out of the army by that time. So what's he doing here on an army base, And so you see that and you're like, wow, that's really interesting. But
And it also did say on his death statement that he was in the army.
professional soldier, it said it,
Yeah.
occupation was
Army.
soldier. Yeah,
Yeah,
that's
soldier.
right. That is right. And so all that, is interesting. Now, the issue that I have is like when I watch it, I see that and I'm like, I know that this guy is not Tim McVeigh. I can tell just by like his eyebrows are too dark, part features of the face. Like I, having researched this as long as I have, I've pretty much seen every photo that there is of Tim McVeigh, And so I look at it and just real quickly, I'm like, no, that's not him. It looks similar to him, but it's not him. But I wouldn't rule out the idea that maybe he was involved in some type of undercover type operation. Just if that video is not real, that just means, okay, that video is not McVeigh. That doesn't mean, we have to throw out the whole notion.
That's where
He
we get
wrote a
the.
letter to his sister while he was in prison saying, I got it somewhere in my notes here, that he was special ops, black ops.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. He said he
And
was recruited.
yeah.
Yeah. To be black ops, to be involved in things like assassinations and drug trafficking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That he was recruited while he was in Fort Bragg with nine others. And so
Yes.
he said basically, we're to work hand in hand with civilian police agencies to quiet anyone deemed a security risk. And he said to his sister, we could be government paid assassins.
That's exactly what he said. And that also caused his sister and mom to think that he definitely was involved in some kind of operation when the bombing happened, because they, prior to that, are thinking that he's involved in some kind of secret stuff with the government. That's what he told them. And they, didn't view him as an unreliable source. They figure, okay, they know their brother well. And they think, well, this is what he says, and that's what's going on. Yeah.
Yeah, I think he at some point in letters written to either his sister or what he told co-workers at his security company, I can't remember who it was. He was like a rent-a-cop for a long time, and he would tell people Or I can't remember if it was there, but he had told people that he had been recruited to into a program that would like root out white supremacist people inside the military is kind of what,
Interesting. Yeah, that one I'm not recalling, but it's probably one of the many details that I just don't remember anymore. And
Yeah,
if
there's
you
so
happen to
many of
come
them.
across that again, to let me know,
Okay.
because I'd be curious looking at that. It's really interesting.
It's in Dr. Wendy's book, so it's in there somewhere. It might have been one of his letters to his neighbor in New York. I can't remember. But I guess I've got a bunch of names written down that I'd like to ask you about, and you could tell the stories probably better than we do. And mentioned Terry Yeake earlier, and you said that's a good part of a well-documented part in A Noble Lie. And guys, A Noble Lie is I saw it. It used to be on Amazon Prime when I first saw it. It's on free on Tubi now, I think.
You can
But
also find it on archive.org, I believe.
okay. What can you tell us about Terrence Yeake?
So Terry Yeake was actually the first law enforcement responder on the scene at the Murrah Building when the bombing happened. He was a police officer in Oklahoma City. He'd been on the force for maybe 5 or 6 years. He shows up at the scene of the Murrah Building. He helps with rescue operations, and he injured his back there when he was doing that. So he's in the hospital, and his ex-wife comes to pick him up from the hospital, and he was very upset. And she's asking him, like, what's wrong, And he says basically that what they're telling us about the bombing is not the truth. He didn't explain to her fully what he meant, but basically he was very upset because what we were hearing in the news was evidently concealing something or not being fully forthcoming enough to upset him as a police officer and as someone who's kind of a stand-up guy. And so he wrote a report to his senior officers or to his leadership. He had to, file a report for whatever his actions were that day. And I guess it was something like 9 pages long. And he got in trouble for that. And his boss basically told him there's a bunch of stuff in the report that he had to remove. And they made him retype it and make it just like one page. And
Was
so
he a
that immediately upset him.
city cop?
He was Oklahoma City Police Department. Yeah.
Okay,
Yeah.
got it.
Yep. And so he got in trouble, and I think it made him cynical, I think, probably made him angry. He saw firsthand what would happen if you didn't kind of go along with the program. And it was something evidently that he had seen enough firsthand to leave a huge impression on him. So basically, he and his ex-wife are like being harassed and, threatened and things like this. And he's meeting with a member of a victims advocacy group named Ramona. And he's been meeting with her, and he tells her the same thing that he said to his ex-wife, that, what they're telling us isn't not what happened, or it's not the truth. And so he is gathering evidence, evidently, and he's gathering materials, and he thinks he's going to be meeting with some federal agents where he's going to be turning over this evidence that he has. And evidently, the evidence is such that he's got multiple videotapes. He has boxes of stuff that he leaves with that morning. And I think that the videotapes are significant. My suspicion is that he may have gone in the evidence room or the Oklahoma City Police Department and made a copy of the surveillance tape that we know was put into the custody of the Oklahoma City Police Department before it went to the FBI. And I think that whatever is on that surveillance tape, it might show, for example, two people exiting the Ryder truck, or it might show something else. So I think he got in there and made a copy. And the reason for that too is that back in those days, if you had a VCR to play VHS tapes, if you needed to make a copy of a tape, you had to have two VCRs. You had your own, you had another one you connected to it. Well, he borrowed from his ex-wife her VCR, and she thought that was strange because she knows Terry has a VCR. Why is he borrowing mine? So he borrows her VCR, And then he gives it back to her and leaves it in her vehicle and tells her, you know, I guess maybe she wasn't there or something. But anyway, he puts it in the car and tells her, you know, your VCR is there in the back seat. So she supposed or he supposedly left a tape, something that he had in there in the VCR. And anyway, the ex-wife Tanya Yuki says that came up missing. The VCR turned up missing when she tried to go get from the police anything that he may have had. They said they didn't have it, and I'm leaving out a big part here, I guess. I should go back to that. Terry's going to meet these federal agents, and he's going to turn over to them his material. And instead, what happens is he's found dead in El Reno, Oklahoma. He's found in a field, hundreds of feet away from his vehicle. He's found in this field where his neck is slit, both of his wrists are slit, and he has a bullet wound to his head that's going from up above down. It almost looks like he may have been on the ground, like on his knees or something, and was shot in the head. And he had wounds. The wounds in his arms had dirt in them, which is consistent with maybe a person's body who's being dragged. And as it's being dragged, this dirt is getting into the wounds. So everything about his death is so very suspicious and looks like a murder. You know, you've got the head wound, you've got the shots, you've got the throat and the wrist slit. You have ligature marks showing that he was tied up or handcuffed at some point. And so all of this points towards murder. And a lot of people who look into this case and look into Terry Yeke case specifically think, well, okay, clearly he was murdered, and they link it to whatever he knew about the bombing and whatever it was that he was trying to bring to people's attention. I
And
think it
then,
was surveillance tapes.
and they claimed it was suicide.
They claimed it was a suicide. Yeah.
Same with Trentadue, which they
Exactly.
said.
Exactly. It,
Do you know anything about the medical examiner that ruled that?
In this, in the case of Terry Yeke, I don't. Like with Trinidu, the medical examiner was insistent for the longest time that it was murder and not, you know, suicide. But ultimately, he was pressured by the feds and the authorities and had to rule it a suicide. And that really upset him. There's videotape of him talking about that and videotape of him talking about how there was foul play here. But with the Yeke case, I don't know anything about whether there was any pressure on the medical examiner or if there was any controversy there.
Got it. Well, let's keep moving. What's going on with the Trinidad brothers?
Yeah, so with Trinidu, you have another very suspicious death that is classified as suicide, that is obviously murder. And what we have there is, can Trinidu match the description of John Doe 2 at the time he was pulled over? He's pulled over because he's crossing the border from Mexico to the United States. And at the time, it was thought that John Doe 2 might be entering or exiting the Canada US border or the Mexico US border. So he's coming across the border because he has a wife who has family down in Mexico,
So he's
and
going into Mexico?
he's coming from Mexico into the
Back.
United
Okay,
States.
got it.
Yeah. And one of the things they do is they'll, like, you know, run you through the system, you know. And he at that time, he had a brown pickup truck, so it matches also the truck that John Doe 2 was thought to be driving. And so they run him, run his info on their computer system there, and they see that he has a parole violation because, you know, when he came back from the Vietnam War in the 70s, he had like a heroin habit, as so many, you know, young men who were in that war did. And as a result of that, you know, he did carry out a couple of robberies, and he served his time for that. He got clean, he cleaned up, he was let out. And so he's let out of prison, and he is recovered, and he's working. He's a family man. He's got his young wife, and they have a young baby. And basically, his parole officer was this guy who didn't believe in drinking, and he basically said that, you know, people he worked with were not allowed to drink alcohol, and they fought that. Jesse, his brother, is an attorney, and they fought this condition of parole, and they were unsuccessful. So Ken Trinidu basically said, well, do what you got to do, I'm going to drink beer. And so ultimately that's what happened. He crosses the border there, and they check the computer system, and they see that he has this parole violation because he had been drinking and had not reported in with his parole or probation officer. And so they basically took him into custody, and he was sent to the Federal Transfer Center in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, where inmates are shipped before they're then sent off to their various
Got it.
locations. Yeah.
Was
So,
what sorry to interrupt. Was this during the time that the FBI manhunt was still going on for John
So
Doe 2?
it was in August of 95, and the interesting thing about that is that they were still looking for him. However, if you were to ask the FBI starting in June, they were saying things like he doesn't exist, to the media. However, in those same reports where they're saying he doesn't exist, and this is also what got my attention back then, is they're saying, oh, but we're still looking for him. And I'm thinking, well, that's just so weird. If a guy doesn't exist, how are you still looking for him? That makes no sense at all. And then you have quotes from a Department of Justice a spokesman named Mullins in 1996, where he's talking about how they are still looking for John Doe 2, and that
Wow.
very much he is still an active suspect. So certainly at the time of Trinidad's being picked up, August of 95, he is John Doe 2 manhunt is still going on. Yeah,
That's
so we think
interesting.
that that may have been why he was taken into custody, and they might have thought that he was the suspect. He's got the powerful build. He has a dragon tattoo on the right arm, or on the correct arm, I should say, that matches John Doe 2. He's the right sort of height and weight. He has a little darker complexion. This is a guy who works outside a lot. He's got kind of like a construction guy's tan. And so he matches these things, and at the same time too, he matches some other things, like in the files that they would be looking at. If they look at his criminal history or criminal record, they would see that one of the crimes he committed was bank robbery. And at that time, there was a group of neo-Nazi bank robbers called the Midwest Bank Bandits or the Aryan Republican Army, and
Yeah, the
people were
ARA.
ARA, and people were suggesting that they were connected and involved to the Oklahoma City bombing. So, to a young FBI agent trying to make a name for himself, if he knows all this and he knows this about from all of his briefings, and he looks at this guy on paper, he looks like a possible legitimate suspect for being John Doe 2. And I think what happened is that there was a case of mistaken identity, and that's what something that Kenneth Trinadu himself said. He was talking to people and saying, they got me confused for somebody else because this is weird. They're interviewing him, they're interrogating him, and all of a sudden, what happens is he's moved to a special segregated housing unit in Oklahoma City, away from others, and he's found in that shoe. He's found dead. He's just found like he's got he's. Beaten head to toe. He has wounds all over his body. There was blood all over the cell. They did a luminol test in the cell, and it just lit up like a Christmas tree, showing there had been blood everywhere. And what's obvious when you look at Ken Trinidu's body is the family did this. They took when they got the body back from the government had put all this makeup on it. Well, they removed all of the makeup and they videotaped the body, showing that he even had bruises and wounds on the soles of his feet, showing
Oh.
that he had been beaten and tortured. And the only reason, I think that the cops are doing something like this is they think this guy knows something, and they think they can use a so-called enhanced interrogation to get it out of him. And well, if the guy doesn't actually know anything, what's going to happen? It's just going to escalate and escalate. And that's what
Yeah.
happened. I believe it escalated until they killed him.
Right. Yeah, it's
Yeah.
either going to escalate or somebody's going to tell them
A
what they want
false.
to hear, you
Yeah.
know?
Yeah, exactly right. And this is the kind of guy who he wasn't gonna do that, He was a tough guy. He fought back, and evidence of that is abundant in the way his body looked when they got it back. Jesse Trinity said we knew, we could tell that if he had not been so much, if he hadn't been the man that he was, they would never have known. But because he put up such strong resistance and a strong fight, he knew based on that that something massively wrong had happened in that cell, and that he had been interrogated. He had taser burns on his body, so these guys, they're tasing him, they're beating him on the soles of his feet. He had bruises. You could tell where guys were holding him, holding him down because of the bruises on his biceps. And so it had all of this points to obviously an enhanced interrogation, as they call it, or I'll just say it for what it is. It was torture. He was tortured to death. And Jesse, the brother, is an attorney. He's a very smart guy, and he, like his brother, is a United States Marine, and Marines don't back down, and he's never backed down on this. He is escalated it to the highest levels in the legal system, and has been filing lawsuits, and has an ongoing legal battle with the FBI over not releasing materials that he sought it to have them be in compliance with the Freedom of Information Act. And I actually work with Jesse closely. He's a good friend, and he's provided me with so much material that I've been able to put online thanks to him providing it, because he wants to see this information out there. So he's worked with a number of researchers. He works with Wendy, works with me, and he worked with Roger Charles, so he's a great guy.
So his mission has gone beyond just his brother. It's the whole case altogether.
That's right. What happened is in investigating the case and with his brother, he talked to JD Cash, a journalist, and JD Cash talked to him and basically said, at the time your brother was pulled over, they were looking for a guy who was 5'10", just about 5'10", 5'11", and he reads off the description of John Doe too, and it matches perfectly his brother. He talks about the dragon tattoo, all this stuff. And Jesse was like, son of a bitch, I can't believe that. And JD then prevents him with all of this other research that he's done on the Midwest Bank Bandits. And so Jesse says, well, I want to find out a little bit about it. So he starts filing Freedom of Information Act requests. And what he notices is stonewalling. He notices a pattern of deception, which tells him that there's something there that the FBI doesn't want people to see. And so he did make a linkage between the Oklahoma City bombing and his brother's murder. And what he wants to do is to get the surveillance tapes from Oklahoma City that the FBI has, because he knows those surveillance tapes would show Tim McVeigh and John Doe 2 getting out of the Ryder truck. And he knows if he has video proof that John Doe 2 exists, then that will lay to rest the FBI's assertions that John Doe number 2 doesn't exist. And he thinks that, of course, all of this in the service of getting justice for his brother,
Is there any speculation on anybody's part of because of Kenneth Trenadue's description who John Doe 2 might be?
Great question, because there are a lot of people who have been named as possibly being John Doe too. And what I have done in my research, of course, is I'm very interested anytime someone is named, and I've looked at all of them. And I can say that of the candidates that have been presented, and I'll go over a couple of them, you have a guy named Michael Brescia. Obviously not him. He didn't have the build. He was just not that muscular and big. His skin tone, he's kind of like freckles all over, kind of like a ginger, where John Doe 2 is like more of darker skinned. So it's not Michael Brescia. There's this Iraqi, Hussani al-Hussani, that this Oklahoma City journalist, TV journalist, just insists is John Doe 2. Well, I've looked at all that, and it's not Hussani al-Hussani. Just any of the people that have been named, Jose Padilla, just absolutely is not him either. The only one that has drawn some interest for me that I think, well, maybe, is a guy named Ali Muhammad. Ali Muhammad has the body type that matches, and he's like basically a special forces guy who was undercover embedded with Al Qaeda. And he, Peter Lance, this investigative reporter, Peter Lance, has written a book about him called Triple Cross. And Lance argues that this guy was like loyal to Al Qaeda, and was fooling like the FBI and the CIA and all that. Well, I tend to take the view that no, he was a good soldier, and he was filling the role for them. He was being a provocateur in this group for them. And so if you look at the type of person he was and what he was doing in this Al-Qaeda group, and associating with these people, well, that's very similar to if you had an act of terrorism in 95, serving this provocateur role, which is kind of what John Doe 2 was. And you couple that with the fact that special forces and McVeigh, like Deborah said, was possibly recruited in the special forces at Fort Bragg. Well, this guy's from Fort Bragg, so he's in the right places at the right time, the right people. So I think it's possible. And this guy, Ali Muhammad, has been in the custody of the government with no trial for over 20 years. They arrested him with on in connection with 9/11, and he's been held at like Gitmo incommunicado ever since. So we'll never know if it's him, because he is just probably locked in a hole somewhere.
Can anybody
If
account
he's,
that he's even still around?
yeah.
no, that's a
That
good
was
question. Nobody really can, I don't think, because if you like look up his Wikipedia and read it just to kind of get a cursory look at what the official narrative is, you'll see that basically he has been out of touch for so long. And I think that also is an indicator that what would happen if he was like a government asset or agent. He could simply be given like a false identity and witness protection, and it just goes into the official story that, oh, he's at Gitmo.
yeah.
We have no idea where Ali Muhammad is. And I think that it's just speculative, but I think out of the candidates who have been presented, he's the only one that makes some sense to me.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense that maybe he could, yeah, be given a different identity, could be on some other mission somewhere else right now, because McVeigh kind of intimated that he thought that that might be his fate instead of being executed. He thought maybe he might be rescued or given another identity and sent off to do some other dirty job. Do you know about that?
I do. He seemed convinced of that. He would talk, he'd mention it to his attorneys a lot, that he kind of thought that they weren't actually going to kill him. And I think in his mind, part of it is like, you can't accept what's going to happen to you. So he invents
Yeah.
this chance that this is might be what's going to happen. And also, who knows, he had the CIA psychiatrist, Jolly West,
Yeah.
Meeting him, as we know now from Wendy Painting's research, and she'll have more information on that soon. But my understanding is, and she mentioned this on the Jimmy Fallon Gong show, so I feel okay to repeat it. She told me in August of, I think it was in August of 22, and asked me not to repeat it at the time, so I didn't. But she confirmed to someone on the defense team that McVeigh had meetings with Jolyon West. And so if he's got the CIA mind control MK Ultra doctor meeting with him, who knows? What if this guy implanted it, in his head? Hey, sit tight, keep your mouth shut, don't worry, we're going to get you out. That could have been something that he had more of a reason to believe than we know of. There could be any number of things at play, here.
That's so crazy. I forgot about that part. He had been, I think he was at University of Nebraska at the time. Does that sound right?
He did a lot of his work at the University of at OU, University of Oklahoma.
Oh, okay. Oklahoma, not Nebraska. Okay. Yeah, that's so strange. And yeah, if anybody, I mean, most people that listen to our show have heard his name multiple times. He shows up, we're big Dave McGowan fans, and he shows up
Yeah, and
all
how
over,
suspicious is that,
all over the Manson case, all over, the weird scenes inside Laurel Canyon, Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic, all that stuff. And
He
then
showed up to interview Jack Ruby even. And before Jack Ruby met with him, he was lucid and normal. And after Jolly West met with Jack Ruby, all of a sudden he is bonkers insane.
oh,
And a lot
man.
of people believe that he was hypnotized and given these post-hypnotic suggestions of crazy things, so he would then be repeating them and sound delusional in the event that he starts to talk. I think that's likely. That's probably what happened. But so oh, you have a pattern here. The government brings in their CIA MK Ultra mind control doctor to meet with Jack Ruby. They bring him in then many years later to meet with Tim McVeigh. I think if you're a person and Jolly West is coming in the room, you're screwed. So,
Yeah,
yeah.
man, it's so crazy. Deborah, do you have any questions or thoughts right now?
Yeah, and again, I apologize for missing the first part, and maybe you covered this, but in the Noble Lie movie, there was a little bit about, I think it was the back side of the building, that agents were there taking out all the files, and it happened to be like where Clinton's Whitewater stuff was, all those files.
Yeah, I do have some thoughts on that. That's an interesting one because that's one a lot of people like to mention. They like to say, "Oh, well, all of the Whitewater files were stored in the Murrah Federal Building, and that's why it was bombed." Now, I personally don't believe that. However, the truth is often very complicated, and there are different shades to it. So, what I can say, and what I do know from people who are involved in the rescue efforts, is that the feds actually did go in there, and they were securing different materials, which would be explosive materials that were illegally stored in the ATF evidence locker. They're securing that, and they also were securing papers and documents that were in there, and they were secreting those out. And they even called off rescue operations several times on people who lay dying in order for them to get out their illegally stored explosives and their precious documents. Now, I don't know that those documents had anything to do with Whitewater, and I have reasons for tending to believe that they didn't, but the very fact alone that they were doing this with any documents is
Yeah.
disgusting, you know, and makes me even more cynical and angry when I see that. And that absolutely did happen. You know, we have rescue workers who are there who can attest to it and say, yeah. You know, this did happen. We had to have a rescue efforts called off when there was a bomb scare that happened. And some people are saying that, well, actually the bomb scare was kind of fabricated to give them an excuse to get some of these materials out that they had stored illegally in the ATF evidence locker. You know, so there is a lot there, and I think that there are shades of it that are true. So I don't like to state with certainty that, oh, there were Whitewater files there, and that's why the bombing happened. Simply because if you want Whitewater files to go missing, there are a lot better ways to do it. And also, you're going to have the majority of those files like in triplicate. Through Kenneth Starr was involved in that investigation, and he has all this stuff like up in New York and in DC, right? And I don't think it would be reasonable for there to only have one copy, and for some reason we're going to store it way off in Oklahoma. It just doesn't make any sense. I think, well, Ken would have copies. There would be stuff in the Southern District of New York. There'd be stuff in DC, but within that, there's a kernel of truth, and there are some things about that are true.
Interesting. What about the blast pattern and the building being blown out instead of in? What are your thoughts on all that evidence?
That's really interesting. And one thing actually that kind of does dovetail with the Terry Yeake story is that official CNN journalist actually did a story about him just this year, 2023, which was very surprising to me. A mainstream media outlet is doing a story on Terry Yeake. It is talking about how there are questions about his death. And they had a quote from his sister in that article. And what she said was that Terry had said he saw evidence of the building blowing up from the blast coming from inside to out rather than something on the outside impacting in. And so when I think about that, I'm thinking, okay, so he saw evidence of this. What could it be? And my thought again goes to the surveillance tapes, because what if that, you know, if there's tapes on surveilling this building and you had footage of that, if indeed there were explosives in the building to go there in conjunction with a truck bomb, you'd see evidence of it on that surveillance tape. You would probably see the building imploding, or pe certain floors, fireballs, explosions happening at the same time the truck bomb goes off, and you'd look at it and you'd know right away that that's, what happened. And so I tend to think that that could be a possibility. And you also see the asymmetrical blast pattern, where if you did have only a truck bomb, you know that it's going to have like a blast radius. It's kind of like a sphere that goes out, like this, and damages things in an even pattern. Whereas when you look at the Mura Building's blast damage pattern, it's asymmetrical, where you have some columns that are further away from the Ryder truck that were completely demolished, whereas columns that are closer to the Ryder truck that are still left standing. And that does not make any sense. So it looks to a lot of people like you might have a situation whereby you had a truck with explosives in it that was detonated and went off. And in conjunction with that, the building had explosives that were placed on the columns that did not entirely, like all of them didn't go off. And so it only took down like two-thirds of the building. And that's a very interesting theory, I think, due to the experts I have read who have looked at this and comment on the blast pattern. And these are people I tend to defer to their judgment on explosives.
Yeah, I think I remember hearing something about the crater below it
It's not right. Yeah.
isn't right for what it would
Yeah.
be for a big ampho bomb like that.
That's right. Yeah. Yep.
Was the bomb? Go ahead.
No, you
No,
go.
go.
Okay. I've read in different sources the bomb was fertilizer and fuel, I think, and chemicals. And then I read somewhere else that it was they said it was ammonia.
Well, it was an ammonium nitrate and fuel oil bomb. So
They
what you
called
have
those
there,
ANFO bombs, Deborah, if you ever hear
ANFO,
that.
yes. So it's a mixture where you have ammonium nitrate fertilizer, which is used by blasters, miners, when they are blowing up stuff, and it's used on farms to blow out if you have like a giant stump from a tree that you've cut down, they'll blow that out using ANFO. And so they take the ammonium nitrate fertilizer and they mix it usually with diesel fuel or a fuel oil and this certain mixture that causes like a chain reaction when a detonation occurs, and it essentially explodes. It creates a chain reaction and an explosion. So what we know though is that there was evidence that there was an ammonium nitrate bomb. That it had ammonium nitrate, it had diesel fuel, and he also included in it nitromethane as a booster. So we know for sure though that there was a bomb that was built with those materials. But in addition to that, I think there is good reason to suspect that there might have been some type of additional explosive charges. And in fact, when we talk about the rescue and recovery efforts, there are some people who are involved in that who said that one of the things Terry might have seen was in the rubble of the building, some of these first responders, which Terry was one, supposedly found undetonated explosive charges. And that when they did the bombs, when these bomb scares happened, there were like three of them that day. And we have that, it's all recorded in official documents. It's recorded in a couple places that there were bomb scares and reported on CNN. And what people are thinking is that what happened is during rescue operations, they found some of the undetonated explosives. They said, "We found another bomb," and that was on CNN. And that's in a noble lie. They cover that. And what's happening is it's a legit bomb scare if you find this, and they get everybody out, and then they secure that evidence and they make it disappear, and we never hear about it afterward.
Richard, I used to be a union iron worker, and
Okay.
when I was in an apprentice, we'd have to go to school for a week at a time, a couple times a year, and they'd have to keep us there for 8 hours a day, and it was like babysitting for them. So like towards the end of the day, they'd pull out these old videotapes. It was like, probably like your experience in high school. They'd wheel in the old
Yeah,
tube
wheel in the
TV.
TV and VCR. Yeah.
But they showed us one, this total, propaganda film, but it was cool. Like it was like emotional and kind of a tearjerker, but they showed these they got like the I forget what local it is in Oklahoma City, but the union iron workers all went down there and worked with did all the rigging with the crane to pull all the stuff out, all the beams, all the twisted rebar and stuff like that. So I'm sure those guys
I'm
awesome
sure they have
stuff.
store they've got stories. There were people involved in that who probably did see some things, for sure. And I think these are people who are, in a lot of cases, still out there. And this is why I think it's important to get exposure on this, just like with that recent Terry Yeake story that was published on CNN. Things like that are important because if we can get the story out and raise awareness on this, that might help motivate people who say, you know what, I was involved in the rescue operation and something weird did happen. You never know what the consequences might be. So it's important, I think, to raise awareness on the subject for that reason as well.
Or somebody who saw something, the same thing as somebody else, and never thought that they
Yes.
could open their mouth about it. But there's strength in hearing that.
Absolutely, yeah.
Like we said, this case is so convoluted and so many different names. I'll give you one more name that I don't think they covered in A Noble Lie that I think is an important one, but pretty confusing. I'm trying to make sense of everything right now. What can you tell us about Roger Moore?
Yeah, Roger Moore, man. He was one who at first in 97, 98, I didn't know as much about him then as we know now, and it's stunning. What you find is Roger Moore was a guy who Tim McVeigh went to gun shows with, and they would split the money for a booth at a gun show where they would sell their materials.
So Tim McVeigh was on this gun show circuit after he
Yeah.
left upstate New York, went on kind of didn't go on the run, but just left town and goes and he's just circling the country, kind of based out of Kingman, Arizona, which was like the hub of this right-wing militia movement at the time, I think.
That's right, yeah.
And he's just traveling to gun shows. He's selling, what's he's doing? He's selling like shirts and
Shirts
stickers
and
and
canteens, army surplus, not,
got
you know. Well,
it.
what's interesting about that too is he's definitely not making enough money to support himself doing that, just selling this kind of stuff, these trinkets, probably not even enough to cover the booth fee. But in doing that and going on this gun show circuit, he supposedly, this is where he meets Roger Moore. Now, my perspective is I believe that he was a meeting between the two of them was facilitated. I now view Roger Moore as probably McVeigh's handler in some ways. Now, what I know about Moore.
Because
So,
everything that Wendy Painting said about their relationship, it seems like they never liked each other.
right. And what's
Like pretty
interesting too
obviously.
is, yeah, they didn't seem to like each other that much, but yet they worked together. And also, Roger Moore, he actually said that he hated going on the gun show circuit and doing this stuff. He hated it, but he doesn't need to do it because he's a self-made millionaire. He's retired with millions of dollars from government contracts where he's building boats for people connected to Oliver North. When we find out about that, you're like, whoa, what the hell's going on here? What it looks like when you observe it, when you analyze it, is it looks to me like Roger Moore was inserting himself into the subculture in order to network with and gather intelligence on people. And he had a federal firearms license and basically sold guns. And what he would do is he would make contacts in doing that. So he essentially could have been doing some sort of traffic analysis where he's looking at different figures, seeing how they know each other. He's getting all of their personal information when he sells them a firearm, possibly even entrapping people. And he has a whole history of doing that. And that was in the paper, you know, it was in newspaper clippings. You find out that Roger Moore was an FBI informant. He was upset with them for releasing his name because when he worked with all these people, he used a fake name. He used an alias. And so what we know about Roger Moore ultimately is that he was building speed boats and custom pontoon boats for the government, for the Navy, and for foreign governments like Vietnam and Panama. Between the late, as early I know as early as 68, all the way up through the end of the 70s. And when you think about it, he's based in Florida and he was active in building custom speedboats at the
Was
very
building
time.
like Miami Vice, like cigarette boats
Exactly.
for
Cigarette
bringing
boats,
cocaine
the
in.
cocaine cowboys, that's right. These are the people he's rubbing elbows with. One of them, a guy named Don Aronow, who is confirmed connected to cocaine trafficking, was a guy that Roger Moore knew and worked with. So he's within this milieu of people who are connected to the intelligence agencies, and he is within this milieu of people who are connected with being things like bagmen and arms dealers for CIA asset groups like, the Contras, the Contra
This
Army,
is all Iran-Contra stuff, right?
all Iran-Contra figures and Iran-Contra stuff. So Roger Moore stands as a connection, direct connection between Tim McVeigh and basically the CIA, as Roger Moore was a CIA asset. He's a bagman for them and selling arms to people that were CIA assets.
And I read somewhere, and I don't recall where, and I'm looking for it in my notes, that the CIA had Tim go to these gun shows to sort of infiltrate and get that info, which is kind of what you're just saying.
Absolutely. This is what people suspect. We don't have so much proof on that, but we do have the receipts to show that Roger Moore, his partner in all this, and the guy who provided the detonators used in the bomb, in the Oklahoma City bombing, he provided those, has a direct connection to the CIA, and that he was a bagman providing the money for and an arms dealer for CIA domestic asset groups like Civilian Material Assistance, the Texas Reserve Militia, TLI, all these groups that we know are directly connected to the CIA. Roger Moore is there selling them guns and providing funding. And so that's like just a direct link to the guy who provided the detonators used in the bomb.
Yeah, and he's an FFL, so he's got lists of names, all sorts of stuff
All that stuff. Yeah.
they would want. And
Yeah.
at some point, Tim McVeigh sends Terry Nichols to go rob him, apparently. Do you think that was a setup just to make Terry Nichols think that he was actually pulling off a robbery, that Roger Moore was actually in on it, and then they were able to take that? He was able to report all his stuff stolen, and then they were able to distribute it to the bigger,
I think
to the militia movement as a whole.
that's pretty much exactly what happened. I think it was a staged robbery, as did the insurance investigator, the neighbor, the police officers who were involved with responding to it due to his behavior and the way he acted. They felt that he was in on it with the person who robbed him. And ultimately, it was a way to sort of launder his guns and precious metals and some of the money into McVeigh's hands. So it's a way to provide him with a way to buy the bomb components and to arrange the plot and to carry it out. He's just transferring this money to them by doing that. And there are just so many reasons to think that. They're laid out pretty well in a book called Oklahoma City by Roger Charles and Andrew Gumbel. And I think Wendy Painting goes into it as well in her book. And anybody, I think, who looks at the Roger Moore firearms robbery would come away with the opinion that he was a collaborator in that, and he pulled off like an insurance fraud, and he was transferring assets,
Yeah,
because
Terry Nichols said it was too easy.
yeah, he showed up, the guy was ready and waiting for him. He'd even moved his van up there to the front so that Nichols could load stuff into it where it wasn't in the spot where he normally parks it. And he was so compliant, even though he had a gun right there, that
Yeah.
he could reach. He didn't like grab the gun and shoot Terry Nichols. So he's completely going along with it, and even going out of his way to point out to him, oh, this is stored over here and the money's in there. And he said it was just way too easy. And the way McVeigh sold it to him, he said, don't worry, Terry Nichols, don't worry. This guy's going to be like a kitten. It'll be so easy. And he's saying that because he knows Moore is going to play along with it, right? He knows that Moore is his partner in this.
Yeah, I heard a couple more quick ones, and I'll get you out of here. I heard Chris Emery on Charlie Robinson's podcast recently, and he said that Nichols might not be the smartest guy in the world. What do you think about that? Like, do you think he has some sort of learning disabilities or something like that?
I don't think he has any learning disabilities. Actually, what I think with Terry Nichols is it's possible that he might be on the autism spectrum
Got it.
or have Asperger's, like myself. And I can understand a position and a person in that situation. In some cases, we can be easily manipulated by a person who's got a lot of guile. And though I think it would be a disservice to characterize him as not being not smart, it's more of an issue of his he has some social deficits, you know. I think that would be accurate.
Okay. Yeah.
From what you were saying just a second ago, it sounds almost like Terry Nichols was sort of entrapped.
Almost, yes. He was certainly influenced very strongly by McVeigh and almost controlled by him. McVeigh used Terry Nichols. He used his credit cards, used his money, used
He
his storage
slaves.
lockers.
Used his wife as well, right?
Yes, even, you know, made moves on the guy's wife. And so Nichols was absolutely manipulated by McVeigh, and I don't think that he I don't want to say he doesn't bear responsibility, because he certainly does bear some responsibility for the bombing, but I don't think that he was a person who was in a planning role for the bombing. I think he was more of like a useful tool that was recognized as someone that could be exploited.
And he was charged with pretty much knowing that what they said he knew that it was going to go down and he didn't tell anybody. Is that what he got?
That's pretty much what they said, and that's why he got life in prison. But the government pretty much failed to prove their case there, which is why he didn't get the death penalty and he just got life in prison, because they failed, I think, to accurately show that he was like a 100% involved in the planning. That it was more like there were some things he knew. He knew that he was helping McVeigh build a bomb. He knew that. I don't think he knew necessarily what the target was, or he might have only had a suspicion that it was going to be in Oklahoma. And one good reason for that too is Nichols gets scared and he leaves the country in the fall of 94. And evidently it's because he thought something that McVeigh was going to do something over the holidays in 94, like around Christmas time. So he went to the Philippines and did kind of a vacation there. And he says he thought McVeigh was going to do something over the holidays. So I think that a good argument could be made that the operation was compartmentalized to such a degree that Terry Nichols was likely manipulated and used, and it does play a role as a convenient scapegoat. Anytime you mention, oh, there was another guy in the Ryder truck with McVeigh, people say, oh yeah, Terry Nichols, but no, he was in Kansas the day this happened, so
Got
that obviously wasn't him. But he's a convenient scapegoat to say, oh yeah, if McVeigh had accomplices, it's this guy. Well, not really. That's not the full story.
it. What
Did you
about
already talk about is his name Michael Fortier?
Yeah, that's what I was going
Fortier.
to ask.
Yeah, so Mike Fortier was, he was a buddy of McVeigh, and I think a better argument could be made that he knew the target and he knew this was going to happen and failed to do anything. And in fact, he was charged for that and went to jail for something like 10 years. But the thing is, he served as a star witness against McVeigh at trial. But this is a guy who I think should have been a co-defendant. You know, Mike Fortier was involved to an extent that he helped McVeigh make the fake ID that he used when he rented rooms and stuff. He helped McVeigh sell the guns from Roger Moore and raise money for the bombing. He was told about how the barrels for the bomb were going to be set up in the back of the truck. Some people even think that he, well, we know for sure he visited Oklahoma City with Tim McVeigh, and McVeigh pointed out, you know, the Murrah Building. But some people think he actually had more of an active role in helping, because at that time Terry Nichols was trying to separate himself from it, which is why you find Nichols staying in Kansas when this happens. And yeah, so Fortier himself for sure has to bear some responsibility, and he knew about it, and they took someone who should have been a co-defendant and made him a star witness.
Did they give Nichols the opportunity for that same deal?
They did not know. He pretty much, they decided, okay, we need someone to put up there
Take,
with
yep.
McVeigh. They've already taken Moore and Fortier, who are both, I think, should have been co-defendants, and turned them into star witnesses.
Got it. Yeah,
Yeah.
and just having the two guys and then like also the people have in the back of their head John Doe too, but there was two guys that got convicted, you know, that kind of just
It
erases
helps
all.
there.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
That's incredible. And guys, this is we'll end it right there, Richard. We don't have to get into any more characters in the thing, but this is all just like surface level. It goes so much more deep, but I think this was a great primer and a great interview, and we can't thank you enough. The one last thing I'll ask is, as a native, I don't know if you're a native Oklahoman, but a guy who's in Oklahoma, what is, if any, the lasting legacy of the OKC bombing in Oklahoma City and Oklahoma, altogether?
Man, that's a tough one to answer. I know in Oklahoma City they have like a memorial to the bombing where the Murrah Building used to be, and it's kind of a memorial to the victims, which I think is fine and appropriate, and that some parts of it are pretty touching, but other parts of it are kind of propaganda. It's almost like if you go to the Sixth Floor Museum in Dallas, Texas, and you see it. It's all 100% the official story. And you're seeing the kind of the same thing happening in Oklahoma at the memorial. And largely, people unquestionably kind of accept the official story about what happened and don't really pay any attention to it. But I think that that legacy and how that's handled, might end if more and more people just simply look at the basics of the case and look at the facts. And that's why I've taken all of my research and just thousands of newspaper clippings I have on the case and put them online at the Libertarian Institute. Now, if you go to libertarianinstitute.org/OKC, you can see all of that. And I just urge a listener to go, and if you have the time, like an hour or something, sit down and read all the news reports that came out in the first 2 weeks of the bombing, because I put them all on there in chronological order. And if you read the news reports that came out on the bombing in just the first 2 weeks, it will be evident to you that there was a conspiracy involving at least 5 to 6 people. It's all right there in plain sight in the news, and it's just people have a short memory. Right, so they just don't remember. The media doesn't do a good job of following up and going back to this. But it's all there. It's including, I have a newspaper clipping that says, right, bold print right there, that the FBI has a surveillance tape that shows the Ryder truck, and it shows that it has Tim McVeigh and another person in the truck with him. That came out and ran nationwide on October 28th, 1995, and it's just right there, cut and dry. Another guy in the truck, and we still today don't know who that is.
You can see the figure, but you can't make out any detail on it.
That's right.
Do you have a overall theory that you're willing to speculate or on?
I don't have a full theory just yet. What I've largely stick to is proving that McVeigh had some accomplices who I don't think that we have receive justice for. But I think that'll change as we learn more. And that's why I just continue to study the case and try to talk to people and interview people and things like that, because I want to just learn as much as I can about it. And maybe one day I will get, a theory as to what happened. I have some things I've speculated on, and people can read about that. If they at my Substack, it's richardbooth.substack.com. Any essays I've written on this are published there. And so they can see some of the things I've written about in that realm.
Fantastic. Deborah, do you have any final questions or final thoughts?
Only that I went to the FBI page and they had one page. I'm sure if I knew where to look, there'd be more information, but this one page said that they had done such a thorough investigation that they conducted 28,000 interviews. 43 followed 43,000 leads, gathered 3.5 tons of evidence, and reviewed nearly a billion pieces of info.
They love to say that. And one of the things they've done is they did the same kind of thing the Warren Commission did in interviewing all these people, some of them only tangentially connected to the bombing, just so they can say, Oh, we did this massive investigation, but one thing you'll find is they're not really interested in showing you the 302 reports of the people they interviewed. Because if they showed you the interview reports, which I do have some of these, you will see that what appears in that does not align with their official story. So they may have collected all this evidence and done all of this stuff, but what they don't tell you is that the grand total of all of that evidence does not support their conclusion. And this is one reason I'd like to see so much of the material that they have on this case declassified or put out there, released, because a great deal of it, you read it and it's immediately apparent that there were other people involved, and they've not been identified or arrested. And you find that not from crazy conspiracy theorists. No, I find this from reading FBI documents,
Yeah, from their words.
their words.
Richard, we can't thank you enough. This has been really good. I'm really excited to get this one out as soon as possible. Thank you so much
Yeah, thank you.
for all the work that you do. How is there ever a day that goes by that this isn't on your mind?
Honestly, there's not a day that goes by that I don't at some point think about the Oklahoma City bombing. And that is rather strange, but sometimes things are a way that it's immutable, right? I think this is an immutable characteristic with me now. But on the other hand, I think that it gives me a drive to learn more about it, write more about it. And so it's been just a pleasure talking to you guys about it. I really appreciate it and thank you. It's a subject that I want to educate others about because I know in my heart that reasonable people, when they look at the evidence, will conclude that there were others involved. And it's just a matter of looking at the evidence. That's all.
I think this maybe this, I don't know if we'll ever know the truth on JFK in our lifetime, and with all these old bo boomers becoming octogenarians, it might die with them, but maybe we'll be like the next generation and this is our JFK, so we need to keep it going and beat it to, we need to get it out there before we're the 80-year-olds, and we
That's
don't want
right.
it to die with us. But like I said, we can't thank you enough, and we'll put all your info in the show notes. And you said you have a book list and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, I'm really happy that I got to talk to you, Richard. Thank you so
Yeah,
much. It's been a long
same.
time in the
Thank you.
making, and yeah, I'm glad we got to do it.
And thank you very much. And it was my pleasure. And I really appreciate you guys. Great discussion.
Great. Thank you. Thanks for listening, guys. We love you all. Bye.
I'm not doing this for you. I'm doing this for me. I'm not signed on to killing all those old people, all those black babies. Fuck you, motherfucking New World Order. I will get your ass. Delay that. It pisses me off. You sign on to playing God, you get burned. And all you dumbasses that serve the New World Order, idiots. Playing God all day. Deciding who lives and who dies.
Penis man.
And then I find out they're all screwing little kids and devil worshiping. Of course they are. Oh, you're the big elites. Oprah Winfrey and Ted Turner and Bill Clinton and Epstein, all in that seven-story pervert building in New York. What a bunch of freaks. And the fact that those pedophiles, and I'm calling Oprah Winfrey one, hope she burns in hell. Every damn one of you's a piece of crap. And you're going to be judged. So you just continue to enjoy hurting babies and hurting old people and hurting homeless people and turn us all into a bunch of idiots. Because you will be destroyed.
Mom, I'm transgender.